Hello, friends. It's Pastor Warren Hoyt. Glad to be with you today as we discuss Dr. J. Richards' book, Money, Greed, and God. Today we want to look at the seventh chapter, Doesn't Capitalism Lead to an Ugly Consumerist Culture? In the book, Dr. Richards names eight myths that many people believe about capitalism. The Nirvana myth, the piety myth, the zero-sum game myth, the materialist myth, the greed myth. And last time we looked at the usury myth, which is believing that working with money is inherently immoral. Today we're going to look at the seventh myth, the artsy myth, confusing aesthetic judgments with economic arguments. And so in this chapter, Dr. Richards talks about how when people think capitalism, many of them think about urban sprawl and strip malls and grasping merchants and these homogeneous suburban developments, these ugly billboard signs and McDonald's hamburgers being served everywhere from St. Louis to Shanghai, a constant drumbeat of consume, consume, consume. He talks about the many problems that we see in our culture today where there's widespread obesity, even among the poor, because people eat too much. And there's a culture today where we buy and buy and buy, and we have to have more and more and more, and we throw away what we buy. I mean, you throw away cell phones after a year or two because you got to have the newest one, or you throw away computers or printers or whatever because you got to have the newest one. So we know about these trends in the culture today that are ugly and worrisome. And the problem is many people associate them with capitalism and think they're one and the same. I like this quote from Dr. Richards. He says, in response to all of this stuff that we're seeing, these negative trends, many have started to seek the more intimate cultural traditions of the past. Some seek simplicity, buying locally and eating organic food and free-range chickens. Others seek a, quote, slow food, unquote, lifestyle that attempts to restore the dignity of the meal. And a few even return to the countryside as new agrarians, giving up the fast-paced life of the modern city for a life lived closer to the land. The responses differ. They're sometimes hard to follow. But the enemy's the same, the modern, industrial, global, consumer-driven culture. And here's a quote from Jim Wallis, a liberal Christian who's often on television. He says, the commodification of everything which turns all values into market values, gutting the world of genuine love, caring, compassion, connection, and commitment for what will sell on a television show. So you hear this a lot about modern culture and the ugliness of it, but it's mixed with capitalism. People think that's what capitalism is. And what Richards does is kind of unravel these different accusations and looks at each of these complaints in turn. He starts off talking about consumerism. He says, you know, both right and left complain about consumerism, and some of the best Christian writers have bemoaned what they see as our obsession with stuff today and how they think that that is an expression of capitalism. Richard says they're rightly identifying the symptoms of a disease, but unfortunately, they're wrongly diagnosing what that disease actually is. There is no sin in the Bible called consumerism. The closest equivalent to it is listed there, however, and that's gluttony. Gluttony, or some call it immoderate desire, is a problem of excess. It's wanting and using more than we need. Okay, fine. We know that that's a sin. In fact, it's one of the ones they call the seven deadly sins. But it's hard sometimes to define what constitutes gluttony, what constitutes excess. I mean, I think in America today, all of us have an excess, don't we? I mean, I have more food in my house, stored in my house here, than I can eat right away. I have more clothes than I need. If you have more than one set of clothes, is that excess? If you have a little bit of food stored up, is that excess? It's sometimes hard to tell. We can see it when it's extreme, but practically speaking, you can't always detect it. I mean, you could have an obese person who's not a glutton. They have a problem with their thyroid, and you could have a skinny person who has a real high metabolic rate, but they're actually a glutton. They eat too much, but you wouldn't know it. You can have a poor person who's just excessive about, you know, possessions and material things, and you can have a wealthy person who has all kind of stuff, but they're not obsessing about it, and their heart is not attached to it. So it's the thing is, it's hard to detect sometimes. It's hard to define. And really what it boils down to is it's an issue of the heart, isn't it? Are we consuming excessively because that gives us meaning or joy in life? Are we consuming? Do we look at stuff or money as our sort of our God that makes our life worthwhile? Are we serving God or mammon? That's the question. And there's no doubt that we as Americans tend to get caught up in marketing schemes and overconsume. Many of us are neck deep in consumer debt. Many people are buying things they don't really need or can't really afford. And so that is not in question. The problem is that many connect all this with capitalism as if they were one and the same. But the truth is, capitalism is just an economic system. Blaming capitalism for all the negatives of modern consumerism is kind of like blaming the internet for pornography. I mean, can you imagine if we said, hey, there's pornography on the internet, so we need to get rid of the internet. The internet is the problem. Well, no, it isn't. The internet doesn't cause pornography. People use the internet for pornography, and that's their problem. But the instrumentality of the internet is not either wrong or right. It's how you use it. Do we really want to get rid of the internet because some people use it for evil? What about all the good things the internet can be used for? Now, the truth is, freedom doesn't cause us to choose the wrong things. It just allows us to. And because some people produce pornography and some other people will buy it, that doesn't make the free market system evil. It's how people are using it that's evil. And Richard says this, besides, there's no evidence that state control of the economy makes a citizenry more virtuous. Every social ill in modern-day America, from widespread abortion and alcoholism to family breakdown, was much worse in statist and communist countries. That suggests that something other than mere economics is at work. We shouldn't expect the economy, free or otherwise, to instill virtue in people. That's the key point of this chapter. Again, mixing things together in your mind is the problem. Blaming the instrument, the tool, for the wrong choices people make with that tool. Here's what many don't recognize. Listen to this quote. Contrary to the stereotype, capitalism is not compatible with a vicious populace. And vicious, the definition is characterized by vice, immoral, or depraved. So contrary to the stereotype, capitalism is not compatible with a vicious populace. Consumerism in particular is actually hostile to capitalism, at least in the long term. Thinkers as diverse as Max Weber and Karl Marx understood that capitalism and overconsumption could not long coexist. In his famous book, The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, Daniel Bell worried that the Puritan culture of restraint that gave birth to capitalism had been lost, leaving a culture of hedonism where mere pleasure has become the purpose of life. Left unchecked, this hedonistic culture, he predicted, would destroy capitalism, unquote. See, capitalism requires financial habits and institutions that allow wealth to be reinvested so that wealth itself becomes wealth-producing. And that requires that wealth not only be created, but that some of that wealth be saved rather than consumed. Delaying gratification is restraint, and that's the opposite of gluttony. So consumerism is hostile to capitalist habits and institutions. That whole section there was a quote as well. Consumerism's hostile to capitalism. That's what we need to realize, and that's what Richards brings out in the book. So capitalism and consumerism aren't necessarily the same things, but many still attribute all sorts of social ills and vices to capitalism. They say it's destroying the traditional way of life, local cultures. It leads to ugly, crude art, music, and architecture. It's destroying communities, turning us into slaves of the economy. Well, Richard says that, you know, back in 99, when they had those protests and riots in Seattle against the WTO, remember that? Back in 99, I remember seeing that on TV. Richards lived there, so he went out among the crowds and he asked the people what they were protesting. And of course, as usual, he found that, you know, they weren't even in agreement as to what they were protesting. Some were protesting one thing and some another. And he says their answers were so diverse that it soon became obvious that most didn't even know what they were there for or what they were talking about. But that being said, still, it was also true that most believed globalized capitalism was evil. That's one thing they all agreed on. Capitalism is evil. It makes everything to one giant Walmart with cheap junk instead of local crafts and pride in workmanship. And it's feeding multinational corporations that don't care about people. It's dehumanizing the workplace. It's using up too many resources. We have to fight against becoming a Walmart nation. And instead, we need to become a farmer's market nation. We need to buy local instead of from these big corporations. That's what all the people up there at the WTO protests were saying. But again, it's it's poor thinking. It's not reasoning properly or correctly. Because, yeah, sometimes it does make sense to buy local. Like if you can buy locally grown fruits and vegetables, that's a great thing to do. Buy local. But Richard says this, quote, "Applied to everything, the advice to buy local ignores most of the basic lessons of economics. If correct, the United States would be better off if we'd have stayed separate colonies, trading goods, services, and capital only within the borders of each colony. And we'd be better off if the individual cities just traded within their city limits. And better off if the neighborhoods, individuals just traded with themselves," unquote. Well, it sounds kind of absurd because it is. But yet it's where this train is headed if we follow it to its logical ending. As we saw when we were discussing the trading game in an earlier chapter, it's advantageous to trade with more people. If somebody in another country or another county can produce a good product cheaper than we can, we should buy it from them and sell them what we can produce better here. Truly trying to go local would soon have us all back to being hunter-gatherers, and millions of people would starve. The expanding markets have helped to bring everybody's standard of living and our lifespans up dramatically. A lot of people just don't realize that. A professor at Drexel University named Kelly Cobb decided to do an experiment to see what it would take to design and make a man's suit, complete with tie and socks and shoes, all with materials made within 100 miles of her home. She had the benefit of living in a highly populated area that combined farms, cities, and ranches. The suit, this is a quote, took a team of 20 artisans several months to produce, 500 man hours of work in total, and the finished product wears its rustic origins on its sleeve, unquote. She says it was ugly. It looks something like what the town drunk would wear in one of those Western movies, you know, where he has his day in court. And also, even with her very best efforts, some 8% of the outfit still came from outside that 100-mile radius she was striving for. On the other hand, if you buy a suit from Hong Kong, Richard says, you can get it in 3 days, and it's cheaper and much better looking. You can go to Joseph A. Banks and get a suit that's even cheaper and far, far better than the suit that this woman tried to produce locally. The point is, most of us, we might bemoan globalization and all that talk about how bad it is, but we don't realize how much better our lives are because of it. We wouldn't have a fraction of what we have, and it would cost us far more if we tried to only produce local stuff. Let's face it, Richard says, Walmart grew not because Sam Walton made a pact with the devil, hello, but because his local store in Rogers, Arkansas made deals to produce and sell on a larger scale so prices could be lower. Customers preferred it to the competition. That's why it went so big. And people, they weren't forced to buy at Walmart, and workers weren't forced to work there either. It grew because it was better. That doesn't mean, by any means, that all local businesses will one day be done away with, though. See, because here's a quote, what small companies give up in terms of financial clout, technological resources, and staying power, they gain in flexibility, lack of bureaucracy, and speed of decision-making. That's why new companies spring up all the time. In parenthesis, he says, Google started only in 1998. And big companies collapse. Think Enron. GM is the largest car company in the world, but it's not the most efficient or profitable. In market economies, most little operations get big, not by getting evil, but by serving customers. So a lot of times these complaints people make are not based in fact or reality, and they're not looking at things in the right way. So in the rest of this chapter, Richards talks about the trade-offs that bring about some of the things people complain about regarding capitalism. For example, a lot of people hate what they call factory farms, you know, the huge farms today that just make it into a big business, and it's not like the agrarian society that we used to have and so on. But the truth is, there's been a revolution in farming. It was called the Green Revolution. Fertilizers and techniques and methods and all made it to where fewer people could produce more food for all of us. That's the Green Revolution. And you might complain about that, but the fact is, if we didn't have these kinds of farms, there'd be less food, it'd be more expensive food, and I'll tell you what, millions of people would be starving. And so what is often spoken of in glowing terms, you know, this agrarian lifestyle, this nostalgic feeling or thought about how it used to be out on the farm, is really just the talk of people who never lived that lifestyle. I was born on a farm, and I can tell you, it ain't as wonderful as people think. It's backbreaking, and you work 16, 20-hour days, and you just, you know, hello, you want that? Really, a whole lot of people are glad that they were able to escape that lifestyle, if you want to know the truth, because of the bigger and more efficient farms. But the thing is, we're so prosperous today, if you want to go buy a small farm and live that agrarian lifestyle, hey, have at it. Our prosperity today makes it possible for a lot of people to do it. But thank God, the rest of us don't have to live that way. See, people talk with nostalgia and all, but they're not very practical. And a lot of times they say, well, beauty is more important than efficiency. It's the greatest thing. And these beautiful little farms and all, they were so wonderful. And that beauty and that nostalgia and all, you know, that's what we need. And so they hate these big, efficient corporations and farms. But what they don't realize is that their thinking is idealistic, not realistic. Beauty is more important than efficiency? Well, not always. If you're doing a fancy wedding, the beauty of the table settings may be something you want to invest in. But if you're bringing supplies to the victims of a tsunami, do you really care about the flatware? Beauty simply is not always more important than efficiency. It all depends on the need of the time. Huge, efficient farms, they may not be quaint and beautiful in the nostalgic sense, but they feed millions of human beings who are created in the image of God. Don't you think that's a beautiful thing? So many complain about our materialistic culture, and with good reason. We all need to be careful of it. God warns us against many of these excesses and this gluttony and so forth. We can all be snared by this kind of thing if we're not careful. But the point is, don't confuse materialism with capitalism. They're two separate issues. People get all nostalgic for the good old days when very often it's because they weren't there or they're not remembering well. You know, you block out of your mind negative things and you think nostalgically because you think of only the positive. You only remember the positive. Constant change is the only thing that we can depend on. You know, change is the only constant. Sometimes it's true that as life moves on, a lifestyle goes out, you know, goes by the wayside. But that's not always the bad thing a lot of people think. Think about whaling, for example. The whaling culture. When people learned to use different sources for energy, whaling kind of went out of style, became obsolete. Because we didn't need whale oil, we could use electric light or whatever, other kinds of petroleum-based lighting, and so on. So the whaling industry disappeared, and the whole culture around it, the ports and the way the people lived, and you know the art that they created, scrimshaw on sperm whale tooths and all that kind of stuff. It all went away, and people bemoan that. But really, do you want to go back to hunting whales? Listen, we almost made them, extinct. Of course not. So things go out of date. They go by the wayside. Yeah, but other industries spring up instead and other cultures and life goes on. We just need to understand that. True, we have a lot of cheap or even sinful art and glitzy junk in our society nowadays. But guess what? Capitalism has also made it possible for millions of us to experience stuff that we would have never been able to experience. Years ago, only the very rich, only kings and nobility could have a concert that they could go to, you know, listen to music or have art and stuff like that. Today, millions of us have access to classical music or art or lots of beautiful things because of capitalism. We're more prosperous, so more of us can enjoy it. So the artsy myth is just that. It's a myth. It's blaming the wrong thing for many of our modern problems. It's like saying, because there are ugly and evil things on the internet, we should hate the internet and shut it down and go back to the way things were before we had the internet. That would be ridiculous. It's a wrong diagnosis of the problem. It'd be a huge step backwards. It wouldn't solve anything. That's the same thing Richard just saying about capitalism. People want to throw out capitalism, but capitalism isn't the problem. Here's a long quote to end this chapter. The cultural critique of capitalism reduces to little more than aesthetics masquerading as economics. Good tastes Don't suspend the truths of economics. Moreover, it is the materialist worldview that even denies the divine, and not capitalism, that's the greater driver of ugliness in modern culture. By pursuing the wrong villain, Christians squander their energies, which could be better spent battling the real culprit, an insidious worldview that denies the great truths of Christianity, truths that led to the greatest flowering of art and architecture, both high and common, that the world has ever known. Unquote. Now, next session, we'll look at the last chapter of Dr. Richard's book, in which he discusses whether or not we're going to use up all our natural resources. He examines what he calls the freeze frame myth, believing that things will always stay the same, assuming the population trends will continue indefinitely, or treating a current natural resource as if it will always be needed. I hope you'll stay tuned for that, or better yet, that you'll go buy his book, because it's really a terrific resource. Till then, may the Lord bless you and prosper you as your soul prospers.